The second case on the docket today is United States versus Carter. The party's ready? Okay, we'll hear first from the appellant.
Chief Judge Erdman, members of the court, may it please the court. I'm Major Meredith Steer, and along with Colonel Catherine Oler, we represent the United States in this case. Appellee sexually abused his biological daughter beginning when she was 10 years old for approximately 2 years. He groped and bit his daughter's breast.
Does that have to do with the issues?
Your Honor.
All the bad stuff he did, those aren't the issues, are they?
No, Your Honor, they're not the issues. I'm just laying out the facts of the case.
Are they relevant to the issues? Because I don't think that they are. So if you could just talk about the issues.
Yes, Your Honor. Well, as it relates to the third issue for discussion, it's
a timing issue, right?
Yes, Your Honor. It relates to whether that offense, child endangerment, constituted child abuse under the statute. For his misconduct, Appley was convicted in February 2010 by a panel of members at a general court-martial. And however, because the terminal element of Article 134 was not alleged on the charge sheet, AFCA dismissed the specifications for failure to state an offense in accordance with Fossler and Humphreys. Failure to state an offense does not bar the government from properly stating the offense and bringing Appley back to trial. That is exactly what occurred here. And once again, after his daughter testified for a second time, Appley was rightfully convicted for sexually abusing his daughter, and his daughter was ensured justice. Turning to the certified issue in this case, the original proceedings were invalid. That is the meaning of failure to state an offense. That was stated by the CMR in Padilla. And again, in Fossler, this court stated, a charge and specification will be found insufficient if it does not contain the elements of the offense charged and fairly inform an accused of the charge against which he must defend. RCM 1107E2 specifically and unambiguously provides the convening authority or higher authority may order an other trial if the original proceedings were invalid because of lack of jurisdiction or failure to state an offense.
Counsel, can I ask a question kind of at the 64,000-foot level?
Yes, Your Honor.
As the CCA admitted in its second opinion, its first opinion was not a model of clarity.
Yes, Your Honor.
But then in its second opinion, the CCA said, this is what our first opinion means. Or at the very least, this is the effect that our first opinion has. Rather than this court trying to create some unified field theory having to do with other hearings, rehearings, new hearings, why shouldn't we simply say that, in fact, the CCA was in the best position to determine what their first opinion meant? We should defer to them. And this is not a problem that needs to be repeated in the future if the government feels that decretal language is ambiguous in the future. They simply file a motion and get it clarified.
Yes, Your Honor. So I think the answer to that is in two parts. First of all, this court looks at the CCA's decision in Carter 2 de novo. And in Carter 2, AFCA recognized that the opinion in Carter 1 actually did contemplate a rehearing or another subsequent proceeding. But found that the problem was not the intent of Carter 1 and what that court intended to do, but based its decision on the scope of the mandate and the remand.
The order said that there was going to be a rehearing?
The Carter opinion, Carter 1, talked about within the discussion of the Moreno issue that any relief that we might afford to the appellant at this time would not be reasonable and would be disproportionate to any harm the appellant experienced as a result of the delay.
But that wasn't the holding, right?
It was not the holding, Your Honor, but it was within the body of the opinion. And federal
circuits... Don't we call that dicta?
No, Your Honor, because in that case, they were specifically addressing whether they should award any relief under Moreno. And in deciding that any relief at that point would not be appropriate, the court stated that that would be prospectively limiting the characterization of the discharge, restricting the amount of confinement, or otherwise limit the possible sentence the appellant might receive at a possible rehearing.
But doesn't and this is following up a little bit on Judge Olson's comment, the CCA wrote the first holding saying the findings of guilty to charge three and its specifications and sentence are set aside and dismissed, and then they wrote the second one saying that that was it, that was a dismissal, there was no rehearing ordered or contemplated.
Correct, Your Honor. However, in Carter 2, what AFCA based their decision on was the scope of that remand, but they failed to take into account the meaning of the opinion and the entire opinion. And the Federal Circuit state that...
But they wrote the entire opinion. It's their opinion.
Yes, Your Honor. However, it's a different panel of the CCA at the time, and they went
back... Well, that's a problem in itself.
Well, Your Honor, the Federal Circuit state that when you're looking at the scope of a mandate and interpreting a remand, you don't just look at the final holding paragraph. You look at the body of the opinion. And when you look at the body of the opinion of Carter 1, it is very clear that they anticipated some type of subsequent proceedings because they had just declared that first proceeding invalid as if it had not happened. It had no effect.
Let's just assume for argument's sake that they didn't authorize or intend to authorize a rehearing. So then where are we?
Well, Your Honor, I would still say that RCM 1107E2 provides that a commuting authority can order an other trial when the first specifications were set aside for failure to state an offense. And that is where we are.
What's the basis for 1107E2 other than dicta in a case we decided 60-plus years ago?
Well, Your Honor, I believe it has its place. And as AFCA discussed in Carter 2, If a court finds that a specification fails to state an offense and therefore never existed, could have existed, then you have to go back to the preferral stage because you have to add in the additional element. You didn't state an offense to attach jeopardy to. So I think 1107E2 does have a place in ordering an other trial when you have the situation, as we did here, for failure to state an offense.
What about Judge Heckler's position that provision is inapplicable because it only applies when a convening authority is taking initial action, coming directly from the court-martial?
Yes, Your Honor, and I disagree with that because there are other portions to the MCM that talk about an other trial, including in RCM 1208, but also in RCM 810, it talks about the procedures for rehearing, other trial, and new trial, and nothing seems to indicate that the convening authority can only take that action before a CCA has acted. And when you read the RCMs together, she's reading a requirement into the rule that is not there. I mean, it explicitly states in RCM 1107E2, a higher authority or the convening authority can order this action.
Major Steer, both Article 66 and Article 67 have language in them that suggest or indicate that if the court sets aside findings of guilty and does not order a rehearing, they should dismiss the charges, right?
Yes, Your Honor.
Now, how do you know when it's a dismissal with prejudice or without prejudice?
Well, Your Honor, I think you have to explicitly state whether something is with prejudice, and that's a case law that's been repeated by this court numerous times. If you don't state that something is a dismissal with prejudice, then it's presumed to be a dismissal without prejudice. Okay.
So the presumption is that it's a dismissal just like everywhere else in the world?
Yes, Your Honor.
It's a dismissal without prejudice?
I would agree with that, Your Honor.
Well, how would the rule of lenity play into this? If we've got a situation where there's ambiguity in its first opinion, the CCA says that first opinion blocks a rehearing, and the rest of the CCA declines to hear this en banc. Does the rule of lenity play into this in terms of this court then reaching down and saying, no, we are interpreting your own order differently? Or should we say, hey, in this type of instance, tie goes to the runner, and the runner is the accused?
Well, Your Honor, I would say that when the standard of review for this court on this issue is de novo, that the rule of lenity does not apply. Again, federal circuits presume that a general mandate is presumed, and they look to the body of the opinion to determine the scope of the mandate. And the MCM distinguishes between dismissal and dismissal with prejudice. Dismissal with prejudice has been held by this court to be appropriate only when an error cannot be rendered harmless. And that is simply not what we had in this case. If there are no further questions on the granted issue, I'd like to address the other two certified issues.
Go ahead.
If we disagree with you on that issue, do we even reach the other two issues?
Yeah.
And if we disagree with you, and if we agree with you on the issue, do we reach the other two issues, or do we send it back to the CCA to consider them in the first instance?
Your Honor, if you disagree with me on the certified issue, then I would say that we are done. However, if you agree with me on the first issue, then we did ask this court to remand the case to the CCA for consideration of the other two issues, as even the Moreno issue was not specifically raised to AFCA. It was only raised on a collateral attack. But I'm prepared to address the granted issues as this court has asked me to. So just very briefly on the Moreno issue, while the government acknowledges that appellate review in this case exceeded 18 months while docketed with the CCA both times, there is no evidence of a lack of institutional vigilance or prejudice to appellant. And this court has previously stated that each phase of the post-trial process is considered separately in determining whether an appellant has been denied due process. In Roach, this court considered that issue and stated that even though the case had been up and down the appellate ladder twice, there had been no violation of the standards set forth in Moreno, and so no need to engage in the Barker v. Wingo analysis. And then in Mackey, this court clarified Roach and stated that none of the time between the actions of the CCA and this court exceeded Moreno. So appellee continually alleges that the delay in this case stems from the judge advocate's failure to adequately staff the appellate defense division. But there is no evidence to support this other than the unsupported proffers by counsel. Appellee never directly complained to AFCA that he should be entitled to Moreno tardive relief for the delay from docketing to decision. And even in Carter 1, Appley only raised an issue relating to Moreno from the time that a sentence was announced to action. He did not actually raise an issue directly to AFCA about the time from docketing to decision.
Now, where is Carter? Is he incarcerated right now?
No, Your Honor. He's not.
What's his status? Do we know that from the record? I mean, where is he subject to more incarceration?
No, Your Honor. Because of the RCM, I believe it's in the 800 series, talks about the maximum punishment that can be afforded even at another proceeding, like another trial, is limited to the maximum sentence that was afforded the first time. And Master Sergeant Carter was released from confinement on the 24th of February, 2013.
So what we're going through this entire procedure not to increase any punishment. We're going to reinstate or instate, however you want to look at it,
yes, Your
Honor. The charges.
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay, so that he has a conviction on his record.
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay.
Major Stewart, could I ask a question just on the tail of the Chief Judge's question now?
Yes, Your Honor.
I understood you to say, and I certainly don't claim to be a guru in appellate procedure, but is an other trial carried out under the same rules as a rehearing? Is that what you're...
Except for the fact that
as far as the sentencing limitations are concerned,
It also requires a new referral in the entire process.
Right. I understand that, but I mean, the whole notion of the sentence limitations once it goes back for rehearing, or what you just said, but all of that applies for an other trial as well. I've never understood the difference, but that's what I'm hoping you'll enlighten.
Your Honor, I'm learning the difference still now, but it appears that an other trial is what the manual contemplates for a situation like failure to state an offense or a mistrial where you completely get rid of the first trial, and so there is no jeopardy that attached. However, the manual has put in the protection of the cap on confinement and other limitations on the sentence separately from a rehearing, but states that this is also appropriate in a case where there's been an other trial. Appley in his Moreno issue says that dismissal with prejudice is the appropriate remedy, and the United States would assert that Appley's request is not reasonable nor meaningful within the context of Moreno. Finally, turning to the second granted issue on the statute of limitations, Article 43 must be read in conjunction with the other portions of the Uniform Code of Military Justice. And that includes Article 67AA, Article 66E, and Article 76, and Article 67E. And this court stated in Lopez de Victoria that it reads the statutes as an integrated whole with the purpose of carrying out the intent of Congress in enacting them. And the UCMJ must be interpreted in light of the overall jurisdictional concept intended by Congress and not through the selective reading of individual sentences within the article. So Article 76 states that the proceedings of a court-martial are not final until they are approved, reviewed, or affirmed, and they are not conclusive until appellate review is complete. Decisions of this court are then subject to review by the U.S. Supreme Court by writ of certiorari. That's in Article 67AA. And Article 66E and Article 67E direct that the Judge Advocate General shall take action unless there is going to be action by the Supreme Court. So, turning to the rules for court-martial, specifically RCM C4, which states, if the decision of the Court of Appeals for the Armed Forces is subject to review by the Supreme Court, the Judge Advocate General shall take no action until the time for filing a petition for writ of certiorari with the Supreme Court has expired. And that is what happened in this case. That time period for filing a writ of certiorari with the Supreme Court expired on the 27th of November, 2013. The charges in this case, in accordance with Article 43, were then received by the summary court-martial convening officer within 180 days as required by Article 43.
So aren't statutes of limitation supposed to be strictly construed in the favor of the accused?
Absolutely, Your
Honor. And it appears that in this case, the construction put on it by the accused is at least partially correct. So arguing in the clouds of certiorari, I question how far that gets you.
Well, yeah.
I was, you know, as a personal aside, I was over there when they wrote that statute of limitations. And I, you know, it was not intended to act any differently from any other statute of limitations. It was intended to be strictly construed like all such statutes.
Understood, Your Honor. And I'm not asking that this court do anything other than strictly construe it. However, you have to give meaning to all of the statutes and the RCM and what the RCM tells the Judge Advocate General that he shall not do. And the RCM specifically prohibits the Judge Advocate General from taking action. Yes, Your Honor.
I have a question on the first issue.
Yes, Your Honor.
So when we decided Humphrey's, right, so Humphrey's error, right? There's Humphrey's error, and we said you could test it for prejudice. It's not structural.
Yes,
right?
Your Honor.
And so, and what we would look at then is we would look at the record, right? And we would say, did they have notice? Like, was there evidence there that there was notice, right?
Yes.
And if we found that there was kind of the notice there, you know, in the record, even though the element wasn't alleged, we would say, well, there's no prejudice, right?
Yes, Your Honor.
And then we wouldn't do anything. We would just affirm, right? So, but when we found that there wasn't evidence and there wasn't notice, right, then we would say, oh, looks like there was prejudice, and we would do our little thing, and we would send it back. Right?
Yes, Your Honor.
So my question for you, and not to throw a monkey wrench into the works, but what is the difference? I mean, the reason for 66D that says that you can't have a rehearing when there's an absence of evidence is because of double jeopardy concerns, right?
Yes.
So my question for you is, what is the difference between prejudice in terms of lack of notice in the record with respect to the element and lack of sufficient evidence? And you can think about it and get back to me, but it's sort of a naughty little question. Naughty as in K-N-O-T-T-Y, but naughty too.
It is. Well, Your Honor, I will take the time while my colleague is arguing and answer that on rebuttal.
Thank you.
Thank you.
We'll now hear from Sergeant Carter's representative.
Good morning, Chief Judge Erdman, members of the court, and may it please the court. I'm Major John Legg, and I, along with Mr. Brian Miser, represent the appellee cross-appellant, Master Sergeant Patrick Carter. Last year, in the Atchett case, this court held that the plain language of Article 66D provides that when a CCA sets aside findings, it may order a rehearing, and it does not, and if it does not, it shall order that the charges be dismissed, and this allowed the CCA some level of discretion in deciding the appropriate outcome. This court should affirm the CCA because it did not abuse its discretion when it determined that dismissal of charges and remand did not authorize further proceedings, whether labeled as a rehearing or a, quote, other trial.
Does this case have anything to do with double jeopardy? Is this a double jeopardy case?
Judge Stuckey, I think that double jeopardy is woven throughout this case.
Well, it seems to, you know, it's sort of lurking back there. But, I mean, it's not being argued as a double jeopardy case, obviously.
Well, but. Judge Stuckey, we did present in our supplement a double jeopardy issue, and we also addressed double jeopardy in our response to the certified issue. And I think Judge Ryan's final question, which I know my colleague hasn't answered that, so I'll just give my answer. I think that everything that the government premises its argument on is on the assumption that the original proceedings were invalid or void. But I don't think Humphreys or the Supreme Court's decision in Cotton allow for that. So what we have here is we have a proceeding that was valid and jeopardy did attach, and we have an outdated rule for court-martial that referenced this thing that's been floating out in the ether called another trial that doesn't appear to be recently endorsed by this court explicitly. And I think the difficult question is deciding what that is. But Master Sergeant Carter, that first hearing, let's assume for purposes of argument.
Well, let me ask you what was asked of the other side. If we decide the certified issue as you want us to decide it, is that the end of it?
I think that is the end of it, Judge Stuckey.
Thank you.
Major Lake, what about Major Steer's position that when the court dismisses, that it is dismissing without prejudice unless otherwise indicated? In other words, the presumption is that you are dismissing without prejudice. Do you agree with that as well?
Judge Sparks, I don't agree with that as a matter of military law, but I don't think that this court has to decide that issue. Mm-hmm. I think that that presumption is applying federal circuit law and getting into this issue of general versus limited remands.
So is your position is that when the CCA in Carter 1 issued its decision, they should have said if they wanted to authorize further proceedings that they were dismissing and the rehearing is authorized or something?
It's not just my position. It's the position of every judge on that CCA, which included...
So you have lots of company, is what you're saying.
...included Judge Hecker. Judge Hecker was on both panels. And even Judge Brown, the dissenting judge, did not believe a rehearing was authorized. There is absolutely no dispute among the judges, either Carter 1 or Carter 2, that dismissal was with prejudice. So I don't think that this court needs to talk about what the presumption is, because the CCA has already told us what it meant. And like Judge Olson asked, is it prudent for this court to establish a precedent of interpreting a CCA's decretal paragraphs forward? And I would argue that you don't need to do that in this case, because every single judge on that panel agreed that they did not intend to authorize a rehearing. And even the government, in their brief, conceded that that's what it meant.
It's basically binary. They either authorize a rehearing or the charges are dismissed and they're gone.
Yes, Your Honor, absolutely. As this court said in Atchick just last year, and of course the CCA, when it issued its decision, it relied heavily on Atchick. What about
my question to the government, which had to do with the Humphreys opinion? And the later decision that it's not structural error, you contest it for prejudice in line with Supreme Court precedent, right? And you would look in the record to see if there was notice, because it's a notice issue, right? And did they defend themselves against it? Did they know about it? And if you said that it happened, then it would be no harm. No, I mean, there was a foul, but there's no harm, and so no prejudice, and we would affirm the decision. If we didn't find that information, we wouldn't, right? We would send
it. Would have been convicted.
Send it back. So my question to you is what's the difference between no information in the record on the particular element and a lack of sufficient evidence?
I think if there is no information on the record on an element, then no rational trier of fact could have presented a finding of not guilty or of guilty on that element. So I think, Judge Ryan, your question is critical to the outcome of this case, because if Humphreys means anything, it means that failure to state an offense is not a jurisdictional defect that results in an automatic dismissal. So Master Sergeant Carter, his first proceeding was not void ab initio. It did not go.
He could have tested it for prejudice.
And he could have remained convicted, but this court affirmed the CCA's determination, applying Humphreys, that there was prejudice, there was a lack of notice. And I would argue that that also, and factual and legal sufficiency were raised to the court below, but they did not reach those issues because of the way they resolved it. But if...
I'm saying, because, I mean, you could have raised it as a legal sufficiency issue, and then it would be nice and tidy and clean, right, that there was no evidence.
Like, and it was raised.
I'm just saying, if we decided on that basis. So this is just a little permutation of that.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I think that that could have been a resolution of Carter 1 had the CCA addressed the issue of legal sufficiency that was raised by the defense. But rather, they simply applied Humphreys, looked whether there was evidence in the record of notice, found there was none, that there was prejudice, and then they dismissed. And we know that that dismissal was with prejudice because the subsequent panel said so, interpreting their
own. And we don't have to get into all this to decide for this case. We could just say they said X, and they are in the best position to know what X meant.
Absolutely, Judge Ryan. I think that would be the most simple way to resolve it, and there's a lot of problems in this case.
A way to resolve the other issue in a case where the issue was actually presented to us.
You could, Judge Ryan. Absolutely, that would be within this court's discretion.
Counsel, now on that point, the government says, well, this court can't take that approach because we're reviewing it de novo. How do you view that?
I'm struggling to understand the basis for the decision. Of course, jurisdiction is a de novo issue, and that was the standard of review cited by the government in their brief on the certified issue, I believe. I hope I'm not misrepresenting my colleague's brief. I think that that's accurate. I don't think that we're talking about jurisdiction. We're talking about failure to state an offense, which is not jurisdictional. And we know that after Cotton and Humphreys, that where there's a defect in an indictment based on the law after the trial, that is not jurisdictional. Supreme Court said so in Cotton. Applying Cotton and Humphreys, this court essentially says that the original proceeding is not void. It's tested whether it should be tested for prejudice. And so I don't know where we get to a de novo review based on jurisdiction. The CCA had de novo review under Article 66, and of course they applied that and determined that everything should be dismissed with prejudice, they explained in their subsequent opinion. So I'm not sure what the basis is for that, Judge Olson. I don't think it's the accurate way to review the case. I think that this court's decision in Atchick acknowledged, although a question of first impression, that when reviewing a CCA's exercise of discretion under Article 66, that it will apply abuse of discretion. And I think that that's the correct outcome here, and I think that the federal cases that we cite applying discretion for a court's interpretation of its own remand also should be persuasive here. Who's in the best position to say what a CCA meant? Well, it's the CCA.
Does it really matter in the end, even if it is de novo, and we look de novo at who's got the best notion of what they said?
I think that that's right, too, Judge Suki. I think even if you assumed it was de novo. But I think the standard of review is important. I think
I
some
think
level
too,
of deference should be.
I'm just saying, you know, even under de novo, we could still say the same thing.
Counsel, obviously one of the problems here was a lack of specificity or clarity on the part of the CCA in the first order. But we also find that in the order of the convening authority. And if we're to take what the convening authority said as being what he intended to say, and that is a new trial is hereby ordered, in our parlance, a new trial is a term of art. And you look to Article 73. Obviously, that is error because this is not a new trial under military justice. And then he cites RCM 1107F2, which is, again, inapplicable. So that is the order that got this whole thing rolling. How do we look at that, and what is the effect of it?
Chief Judge Urban, I think undoubtedly the convening authority's order had some errors. It also said that the original decision only set aside the case. It didn't acknowledge that it dismissed it. I think the best way to deal with it is probably the way that Carter II dealt with it, which is essentially point out the error. They gave some level of a nod to what the convening authority, what they thought they were trying to do.
So it doesn't matter what he thought he was trying to do because he wasn't authorized to do it.
I agree, Judge Ryan. I agree that the convening authority didn't have the power to do what he did here.
Or what he tried to do.
What he tried to do, yes, absolutely. Chief Judge Urban, you might be thinking third-order effects beyond what I anticipated in brief. So I agree that the convening authority made some errors, and that's problematic. I don't think that the court has to reach those errors if it simply applies Article 66, abuse of discretion for a CCA's interpretation of its own remand.
Well, we spend a lot of time today talking about what the CCA did, and in fact, what got this going was the convening authority.
Yes, Your Honor. The convening authority on the advice of the prosecution, and of course, the procedural history on that is interesting, to say the least. It's a messy case, Chief Judge Erdman. And I think the simplest way to deal with it is to allow the CCA to say what it meant, and that a rehearing was not authorized. It was a dismissal with prejudice, and I don't think the convening authority had the power to order another trial. And in that sense, I think, I'm not sure it's necessary to resolve this case, but we have made the argument that the status of what an other trial, as it's currently stated, or in the 1951 manual, another trial, what that is. And I don't think that there's clear authority from this court or its predecessor courts endorsing that concept, but I don't know that this court has to wade into that. I do briefly want to address the granted issue on the statute of limitations.
Before we get to that, may I just ask one question? Let's say 2 years from now, CCA uses identical language. There is, in the decretal paragraph, there are similar statements as in this case in the body of the opinion. If the government were to file a motion and ask the CCA, did you mean to do the same thing here, as in Carter, would the CCA have the ability to say, no, we meant to authorize a rehearing?
I think the answer to that is absolutely yes. I think the CCA could have authorized a rehearing.
So we would not be handcuffing anyone in terms of getting into a situation where if there is a slip of the pen, so to speak, on the part of any CCA, where they fail to specifically articulate that a rehearing is authorized, where that would be forbidden going forward. Because in any of the CCAs, the government could go file a motion and say, clarify.
Absolutely. As the government did file a motion for reconsideration here, and they could have asked for that in their motion for reconsideration. In the Atchett case, they asked for reconsideration. I think, you know, in Atchett, this court pointed out that sometimes when that's a guilty plea case, of course, but the opinion of the court pointed out that frequently rehearings are authorized, but the CCA under Article 66 is tasked with reviewing the whole record and determining whether it's appropriate to authorize it, and that's why discretion is applied. And so in the same here, the CCA was tasked with reviewing the whole record. They didn't reach all the assignments of error, but perhaps in their review of the record, they determined this does not need to go back to a rehearing. And in Carter 2, they said we didn't authorize a rehearing. Government could have clarified that. They did not. They were capable of it, and this court isn't preventing the government in any other case from being abundantly clear if they believe that a CCA's opinion is ambiguous. With the time remaining, I don't intend to spend any lengthy amount of time on the Moreno issue.
Would you address statute of limitations?
I do want to address statute of limitations, Judge Stuckey. I think the rule of construction in terms of whether they will be interpreted in favor of repose or not, I think it's very similar to the case this court just decided by analogy in the Fetro case, where there was a rule that MRE 414 would be construed strictly. And then you had a list of statutes that would qualify, and you had a CCA that said it's not in the list. And here you have Congress saying to be a child abuse offense, it has to constitute, that's the phrase or the word that Congress used, it has to constitute offenses. It lists offenses in the UCMJ, and it lists offenses in Title 18. And child endangerment isn't listed. It's really that simple. It's not a listed offense. And if you interpret it strictly and require the government, if they want to get rid of the statute of limitations, it's very easy. Congress can do so. They can simply add child endangerment to the list, and then there will be no issue. I'll note that we didn't raise a statute of limitations issue to the other specification here because it's on the list. So it's a list. It doesn't require a lot. You have the word constitutes. You have multiple words in Article 43 that focus on charge, offense. Although there is a reference to the Act, it says the Act has to constitute, and then it lists the offenses. So the protection of the statute of limitations is not on the facts and the acts, as the government said in its brief. It's on what they ultimately decide to charge that constitutes the offense. If Congress believed otherwise, they could have told us. We respectfully request that you affirm.
Thank you, counsel. We'll now hear from the government on rebuttal.
Judge Ryan, to address your question about prejudice, I believe my colleague and I are somewhat on the same page with that, and that would be prejudice in a notice is the government's theory of the case and gives the accused in a case notice of what he has to defend against. Versus prejudice and the lack of insufficient evidence is when the government's case and the evidence presented failed to meet and prove beyond a reasonable doubt each and every element. And so I'd say that's where there's evidence. The second prejudice is when double jeopardy attaches, not in the first instance.
Right. My question to you was how could we look at something and say that there was prejudice in terms of there was no notice because we couldn't find any information about it in the case. How could that be true and nonetheless there was evidence of the element? Do you see the point? Like if there was evidence of the element in the record, how would we say that there was no notice?
Well, you would say that the accused is on notice at that point of...
So then we would have said that there was no prejudice.
Correct.
Right, but when we say that we found prejudice... I'm sorry.
That's because there's a lack of notice. Your Honor, if I could submit a supplemental briefing on this point, I would like to do so.
Unless someone else is interested, I mean, who's interested?
I would also just like to briefly touch on why this is a jurisdiction issue, and that's relating to what a mandate is. And a mandate transfers jurisdiction. It returns jurisdiction to whoever it's being mandated to. And that is why this is a de novo review, as in all other jurisdictional issues. The question for this court is whether the convening authority had jurisdiction within the scope of that mandate to order another trial. And in McMurrin, that case stated by the Navy Marine Corps Court, which was petitioned to this court, and that McMurrin petition was denied, McMurrin stated a lower authority is free to decide other issues not addressed by the mandate. The mandate in this case did not address whether any other proceeding would be envisioned, and in fact envisioned that there would be a further proceeding.
Counsel, just a precaution. Our denial of review means nothing.
Yes, Your Honor.
Just like the denial of certiorari over there means nothing.
Understood, Your Honor. May I briefly conclude?
Please.
Appellee was rightfully convicted a second time at an other trial as permitted by the MCM case law jurisprudence and AFCA's general mandate. Appellee has not been denied due process of law. The child endangerment specification, likewise, was brought to trial within the savings clause of Article 43, and therefore Appellee's convictions for sexually abusing his daughter should be upheld and affirmed, and the Air Force Court's decision in dismissing the charges with prejudice must be reversed.
Thank you, Counsel. The Court thanks Counsel for both parties. The case is now submitted, and the Court will be in recess until 9:30 tomorrow morning.
All rise. Court is adjourned until 9:30 tomorrow morning.